welcome back to the program. It's often said that the scariest 9 words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Yet it's government that gave us the interstate highway system, put a man on the moon, created and administered the Marshall Plan, created some of our great state university systems, and so much more. What's happened? While even the founders were suspicious of a strong and overreaching government, they saw the value of a self-governing democracy and what it could accomplish. We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, William Eggers. He's the Global Director for Deloitte's Public Sector Industry Research Program. He's a recognized expert on government reform and the author of a new book entitled, If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Things Done in Government. William Eggers, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you this morning, Jeff.
Good to have you here. Has it always been that we are suspicious of and look for the failures of government, or is this a more recent phenomenon?
Well, certainly it's part of our just who we are in America and our founding that we've been suspicious of government and certainly of an overreaching government. And we've always wanted to have a government that does as little as possible, but when it does things, that it does it well. And what we wrote this book because the government attempts, massive undertakings today, from healthcare to the environment to the economy. And we want to, how do we make sure these plans are followed through with effective execution? We want to, we don't know if these initiatives are going to become our newest proud achievements, joining the Marshall Plan, victory in World War II, the moon landing, or are they going to flop as badly as the first years of the Iraq War, the response to Hurricane Katrina? And we wanted to write a book that would give us a much better chance of succeeding.
Is the problem that government today simply is trying to do too much, that it simply is not capable of taking on effectively as many tasks as it has?
Well, I think that's a part of it. We actually surveyed the members of our senior executive service and the members of the National Academy of Public Administration, so the nation's, the people who are running these large programs for us, and the top scholars about it. And they did say that one of the reasons why we're not as effective as executing today as we might have been 30 years ago is that we're not able to focus our attention as well on a few of these initiatives because we are doing so many things in many respects. But, I think one of the main themes of the book is that it doesn't matter whether you're a liberal or conservative, you still want to get big things done in government. If you're a liberal, it might be universal health care, but if you're a conservative, it might be choice in education. And effective execution is just as important for actually making government smaller as it is for making government bigger. And sometimes those on the center-right forget that important point.
What is it in the structure of government today that makes efficiency and success, if not antithetical, at least so much more difficult than it is, say, in the private sector sometimes?
Sure. I think that we examined 75 major undertakings since World War II. It was a massive research thing. We looked at everything from the war on poverty, the war in Iraq, and we looked at immigration reform and so forth. And what we found was that there are lots of ways this initiative can end in disaster, but to have a happy ending, they have to have a good idea. They have to have an implementable design. The design is to win legislative approval. Then there must be competent implementation and must produce the results. And our findings was that a lot of the so-called implementation failures that we see actually lie with faulty design. We have a process to where there's kind of the political world, which does the policy design and the legislative drafting, and then the bureaucratic world where it's implemented. And there's a big gap between those worlds. Less than a third of the people running our government today say that Congress is effective at designing public policy that works in the real world. And this kind of big gap between those who design it and implement it causes a lot of problems. And we saw this with California electricity deregulation back in 1998, which I'm happy to talk a little bit more about it, if you like.
How much of the problem also is the complexity of design? I mean, one of the things that we know that the legislative process does is it builds in added complexity in the process. Now, part of that is a result of compromise. Part of it is a legitimate result of how the democratic process works at its best. But when it comes to transforming that into implementation, it has within it certain inherent problems.
Well, I think the complexity is the problem that we found is that oftentimes when legislators are designing a bill, they're designing a bill that can get enough votes to pass through the legislature as opposed to one that can work in the real world. Take the California electricity deregulation. 1998, the bill went into effect after it was passed 98-0, you know, in California. That never happens with the California legislature. 2 years later, it was a complete disaster. You had rolling blackouts. It was costing consumers $40 billion. Governor Gray Davis was booted out of office. So what happened? Well, the legislators thought they were writing a bill to pass the legislature, not to work in the real world. And this was a radically rethinking the way that they did essentially electricity deregulation. And yet, at the same time, they didn't do a bill that could be Enron-proof, essentially. And what would happen was there's a lot of gaming in the thing. And we find this time and time again where the scenario planning and war gaming of all the different things that could go wrong are not done during this stage. And I think in the private sector, they do a lot more prototyping and piloting and other things before they're going to put a product out for millions and millions of consumers. And I think we need to do a little bit more of that, a little more beta testing before we fail at scale, like as we saw with the electricity deregulation.
Is one of the problems that government does not do things on kind of a beta testing basis, that it always immediately starts up at its maximum scale?
Well, yes, I mean it doesn't always happen that way, but you know that we found a lot of successes, and you know a lot of these successes were based on smaller successes where we had seen. So, take welfare reform. Welfare reform was one of the great public policy successes of the last 20 years, and it was successful because you had a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, and a Republican Congress who are getting together, and that tension between the two is usually helpful in these. But they also was tested in the states before him. It was reform that took a round-trip journey. It started in the states in Wisconsin. Washington took what they had done and sent it back to the states again. And so there's a lot of tangible evidence that it could play out and work in practice. And when you think of things like whether it's health care reform and a lot of other areas, the more of that experimenting you can do at the state level or local level in terms of laboratories of democracy, the better, because once these bills interact with the real world, it's always going to be different than we thought when we're simply in the laboratory of the legislative body.
Talk about some of the other government initiatives that have worked well. We've touched on sort of a lot of the problems. Talk about the ones besides welfare reform, the larger initiatives that have been successful.
One of the ones we talk about in the book is acid rain reduction. If you recall, during the 1980s, the acid rain was one of the biggest environmental problems in our country. It was killing fish in lakes. I lived on Lake Michigan. We couldn't even go to the beach there because it was absolutely covered with dead fish caused by acid rain. Yet despite the fact that everyone knew this was a problem, there was an impasse between environmentalists and business interests. 70 bills were proposed in Congress, not a single one passed. And into this impasse walked two senators, Tim Wirth from Colorado, a Democrat, Jack Hines from Pennsylvania, Republican. And what they did was they brought economists into this room of environmentalists and business interests, and the economists looked at it in a different way. And they came up with a very innovative solution, essentially, to cap the rate of pollution at half the previous rate, which is what the environmentalists wanted. But then business could use any method they wanted in order to get below that cap. And so it was essentially tradable emission permits. And neither side loved it, but it was acceptable to both. It ended up in a 40% reduction in sulfur dioxide emissions. It's considered one of the greatest environmental successes of the last few decades. And again, they were able to break free of kind of this bias, confirmation bias, and find a bipartisan way of solving an important initiative. And we found, you know, time and time again with some of the successes, it had that pattern. Massachusetts healthcare reform, it was a Republican governor, Democratic legislature, and again, they were able to agree on the data and move forward with a market-oriented approach to deal with the healthcare issue and offer universal healthcare insurance for Massachusetts residents.
Are there any specific patterns that we can find between the successful projects, NASA's success, the Interstate Highway System, the Manhattan Project, and some of the great failures that we have seen? Are there clear patterns that emerge?
Well, certainly there are patterns. We actually identified seven, what we call the seven deadly traps of initiatives that public initiatives often fall into, and the successful initiatives were able to avoid some of those traps. We've talked about a few of them already. One is to break free of bias. You need to have a good idea, but if your idea is basically based on a confirmation bias where you're only looking at evidence that confirms your worldview and you let ideology get in the way of what works, you're often going to have a bad idea to start with, and there's nothing you can do later on that's going to fix that. You need to design for execution. You need to design the policy so it can actually work in the real world, not just for the photo op or just to get through the legislature. Another thing that we found is important is to take failure seriously. In the public sector, everything is a lot harder than it seems. And you don't want to be overconfident, and this kind of the congenital, unrealistic optimism of the political realm often makes the job harder, because the more you accept the possibility that this might fail, the more you can take steps to reduce the likelihood of failure. And so that's a really, really key insight. We found that more initiatives fall into that trap than just about any other.
To what extent do the stakes that are at play have something to do with the ultimate outcome? When you look at things like the Manhattan Project, like NASA putting a man on the moon, I mean, those are things where arguably failure is not an option. I mean, do the stakes matter?
The stakes certainly do matter, but we do argue that failure is always an option in this, and the more you recognize that, the better. I mean, the stakes in Iraq were very, very high, right?
Mm-hmm.
The stakes in the recovery in New Orleans were very, very high, and they were not very successful. And so, essentially, the stakes being high is certainly important, but it's not enough. These initiatives all follow a pattern. And what we need to do is we simply need to take the process of getting big things done in government more seriously. We spent all this time in the last few years in this political screaming match, and we see this ultra-partisanship because process is dull, politics is exciting. So the media focused 24/7 on the political infighting between the red team and the blue team, and it confirms everyone's mistaken view that the mess is the other team's fault. Leaving no one around to tackle the hard work of improving the process by which we tackle the big challenges. And I think the examples that you gave are examples of where the stakes were so high that we had to get beyond that sort of red team, the red team, blue team fighting, and just say, look, we have to get this process right, and we have to put some of that stuff behind us. And we're at that point today, I think, in our history, where we've never seen a time in recent times where we're facing so many challenges, yet where the American people had so little confidence in government's ability to meet those challenges. There's very, very little margin for error right now, but we're not going to get out of this kind of impasse that we're in, this trap that we're in, until we take the process more seriously.
And part of the problem, and Tom Friedman, I think, maybe put his finger on this very cleverly yesterday in his column, talking about this idea that we can't optimize the solutions to any of these problems because of the inherent politics involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, that is a lot of why we wrote this book, was because, but I think the problem is we've got lots of examples throughout the throughout the book were in very partisan times where the sides were able to reach out and essentially structure what we call a mashup almost, where you might take a liberal ideal, combine it with the conservative market-oriented approach to come up with a new and better way of delivering a service. And I think that one of the problems we have today is that we don't have a diversity of viewpoints, which are being included in a lot of these debates. Each side will have their own people testifying, and they know what they're going to say ahead of time. And I think, you know, I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley. I spend a lot of time with the tech community and talking to a lot of people who are doing some of the most amazing things right now in our country in terms of innovation. Let's get some of their ideas into the public policy process. Let's get scientists. Let's get others rather than just simply the same old thing in terms of the lobbyists and each of the political parties. And I think we can rise above this. We've seen examples of it before, and it can happen again. But we need to go about this in a different way than we have so far.
Why don't we seek out those other ideas? And is the responsibility entirely on government and legislators to go about seeking out those ideas from the private sector? Or does the private sector and business have a responsibility to be more aggressive in seeking to make contributions?
Well, I actually believe that government needs to create an environment and in order to let this happen and to basically fashion this sort of a thing where they've got the systems and processes to make it happen. And so one example of a positive thing going on in this regards is the Obama administration has a really innovative technology policy where they're opening up all the government data to anyone who wants to use it, any entrepreneurs who want to take it and do interesting things with it. They're basically opening the door to technology entrepreneurs and innovators to help them produce what's called Government 2.0, and I wrote a book on that 5 years ago. And what they're doing is they're saying government kind of is the platform, and what we want is all these people to be developing apps off it, like you develop apps off the iPhone.
Uh-huh.
And so they've set up a process and a structure to enable that to happen. And there are plane loads full of people going from Silicon Valley to Washington back and forth now with those ideas. Unfortunately, they're not spending enough time, I think, in Sacramento at the same time,
right.
which would be a lot closer. And so that's an example of creating a process and a system to say we're open for business. We're moving from a closed to an open system, a hierarchical to a network thing where we're going to insource the best ideas from anyone, and we're going to change our organizations. And before business can fully develop, government needs to have that sort of an open-door policy.
One of the things you talk about is the importance of embracing risk to a certain extent. You know, it's the old story, you can get in a lot of trouble for not doing anything, but you can get more trouble for doing something. Talk about the importance of embracing risk.
Yeah, you know, we actually, as I mentioned, we found that more initiatives that failed fell into this overconfidence trap than any other one because they essentially did not look at all the different ways that it could fail. One of the classic examples of this is, fortunately, the Challenger Columbia catastrophes, where in both cases you had a warning of something that could go wrong, but it didn't end in catastrophe, and so people started to ignore the warnings. That's what happened with Columbia. The foam fell off, and what happened was that they didn't grow too alarmed, and in the same way, we've been hearing, you know, these same sort of deficit. We've been hearing the same alarm bells about deficit spending for 25 years and grown accustomed to it. So it's one of those things to where if catastrophe doesn't happen, you start to grow complacent about it. And what we're saying in the book is that looking at risk and mitigating against risk is absolutely crucial for these to be successful. We profiled London congestion pricing, where you had essentially a socialist mayor, Red Ken Livingston, who introduced a market-oriented principle, which was congestion pricing, the first city in the world to actually introduce a congestion charge to get into the city. And there's so many different ways that that could have gone wrong, and he could have ended his mayorship, and he wouldn't have won a second term. They spent 2 years war gaming and scenario planning against every single one of those things and doing a lot of that. And that ended up resulting in a completely successful initiative when they launched it, but it was successful because they knew it could fail. And I think that's a very, very key element of a lot of these public policy proposals. So when you look at the healthcare reform, we don't really know what a public option would be like in terms of how it would operate in the real world. We don't have a lot of examples of that, if any. We don't know how a variety of these things would happen. So what's imperative then is that you have a lot of smaller prototypes, you have a lot of smaller pilot experiments where you look at what could happen and you fail small and fail fast rather than failing big and at scale, which is what often happens in government.
And yet the politics of it are so problematic. I mean, if we look at Afghanistan right now and the president taking the time, arguably, to decide, A, what we should do, B, what the exit strategy is, and finally what all the options are, he comes under criticism for spending time examining all of this.
I know I have thought that's very ironic, that the fact that he hasn't rushed to judgment and been criticized for it, but I think history in the long run will look well at that decision, because he's making sure he's looking at the design of this. He's looking at all these different issues that you need to look at. We've had a number of big initiatives that we've rushed into in recent years, and they haven't worked very well. That's not to say that we want to have paralysis by analysis, which government is often doing. But what you want to be doing is you want to be moving forward, but sometimes incrementally and quickly, again, where the more you can structure these initiatives so you can have a lot of very quick and fast experiments that either work or don't work and then move on, the better. You know, we also profile New Orleans, which after Hurricane Katrina, they washed away the existing dysfunctional bureaucracy, the school board, the contracts, the administrators. They started with a totally clean slate. Over half the schools in New Orleans are charter schools right now. It's the most radical educational experiment in the country. Now, not all of those schools are going to work, but when they don't work, they're going to be shut down after just a few years, as opposed to having decades and decades of failure. And again, that moves towards this notion of, if you are going to have a failure, do it quickly and do it in a small way so we can learn from it and move on.
Is there more willingness to look at how the private sector does things in terms of the way government operates?
Well, I think we've always had a willingness to do so. But people then point out the fact that government is different than business, and they point that out correctly. We talked about this notion of moving through the legislature, which we call the Stargate, because it's moving from one world, the political world, to the bureaucratic world, and they're radically different. There's no such thing like that exists in the private sector, and the Stargate can be very distortionary. And so what we have to understand is that the terrain of the public sector is much more difficult to operate with, and you have all of these incentive issues and cultural issues and rules and regulations that simply don't exist in the private sector. But once you understand that terrain, and once you understand that it's very, very different and you need to operate differently, then you can apply a lot of commercial best practices to it. But you're not going to be able to do them exactly the same way. But, you know, we're in an age right now of exponential change, where technology is changing so dramatically, and it's not slowing down. It's moving more and more quickly. And government's going to have no choice but to learn a lot more from the private sector and to learn much more quickly from it, and to do a lot more, I think, partnering with some of the most innovative firms that we have. And a lot of them are located right there in California.
William Eggers, the book is If We Can Put a Man on the Moon, Getting Things Done in Government. It's just out from Harvard Business Press. William, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.